来，那边的就是这样一个。
Yang lagu tinggi badan bukan jauh mata. Kecil tapi zaman zaman lama jauh lama. Kebiasaan nama barangan bukan jadi hati.
Ati yang tu, ini semua sahaja hamba. Ini sahaja dong, tatar sahaja dong, mamba sahaja hamba. Jodoh cipilam, itu. Jodoh cipilam dekara ni senam. Shanti pesen pilam, shanti pesen pilam. Dalam tenne, tenne dia sahaja kubah kata. Tenne tatar. Juga sahaja, namun sahaja, hamun je dalam syarikat kesendirian, dene, dene berikut topik itu, dene marum topiknya, dah, dia sahaja kelain, kan tu kan topiknya, na, na, syarikat kesendirian, syarikat kesendirian, siapa lah juga ni, macam mana macam ni, dah, oh, dia sahaja dah. Lih tak sih cuma lah sopat, kira cuma lah sopat ke, melainkan, lain lagi orang yang nang tandang melainkan bukan orang yang naik, syarikat sendiri tenar nang, sendiri yang dia lah, cikar dia lah, pardo dia lah, kira cuma dia sanggup, dia dewar bayar cuma tu pun dia pasti sanggup, dia tu sendiri cikur tau lor cikur tau kan bukan orang yang naik. Cantik sendiri, amen. Cantik sendiri, syubala juga. Karena hajar, setawa cium bata. Mereka barang macam ini. Karena kemunculan kesanjir dalam cantik sendiri, ham, jadian, lam, deh, seru jadinya sulam yang ada. Dan ini, jadi sanjir. Right? Dan ini, tarikh itu lama kebiasaannya. So, kiam, dan ini lam, deh, yang sulam yang ada. Dan ini, orang tuh dalam cantik sendiri. Terapi. Tapi yang tu, dah orang tu nampak juga ni, orang tu cukup sihat, jangan tu orang cukup sihat, tapi yang tu orang tu cukup dah, jangan tu orang cukup dia tu cukup mana, dia nampak juga jangan tu orang cukup dia pun cukup mana, tapi ah, orang cukup sihat, dia lah tenar, tenar jangan tu orang cukup sihat, yang apa cukup cukup, jadi ada. Kecuali dia boleh orang, dia yang bikin na, ni lambat saja tu boleh.
So in summary, we could say that the path that has been followed by all of Buddhism in three times, whether they take birth in the past, present, and future, is certainly this Bodhisattva path, which is being laid out by this text. By following this path, one will certainly attain Buddhahood. And Rinpoche said that even includes practitioners now who are on the path. Either one has the capacity to obtain a Buddhahood in the present or in some lifetime in the future. But in any case, it is following this path in a traditional manner that enables us to attain the result. So if we're a person who either accepts the idea of enlightenment or is sort of open to that possibility, for us then, understanding and practicing this way of the Bodhisattva is absolutely necessary. When we talk about the result of the Bodhisattva path, it's possible that some of us may not accept the idea of future lifetimes or more than one lifetime. And Rinpoche said, it's okay if you're not sure about that. That's something that you can explore and grow more comfortable with, if you like. But in any case, when we're practicing the Bodhisattva path, we can still feel assured that we'll become happier in this very lifetime. for just all the reasons we were talking about earlier, just openly sharing and giving to others makes us happy. But if we do believe in future lifetimes, it is said that the Bodhisattva path brings us ever-increasing happiness, whether it be in this life or the process of dying in the borrowed state in the future. We are certainly becoming increasingly happy. Lamas who are teaching on the Dharma today, all of them are also taking up the Bodhisattva path. And their ability to benefit both themselves and others through the Buddha's teachings is possible because of the Bodhisattva path. And in the Buddha's teachings, we say that when we take up Bodhisattva conduct, this enables us to realize the qualities of enlightenment. So these are just words that you may not be familiar with, but one, we say the Dharmakaya, which is the expression of realization for oneself, which enables us to completely benefit or liberate ourselves. And the second is the Sambhogakaya. This is an enlightened expression which is capable of connecting with and benefiting others. So when we take up the Buddha's path, when we practice bodhicitta, we're able to realize both of these aspects, and we can accomplish both our own benefit and the benefit of others. So if we are practicing the Bodhisattva path, which is leading us to Buddhahood, we should have no doubt that we will certainly be able to benefit others.
Mm-hmm.
They told them, you enchanted, took the one.
대처 면 체체토 마득나 스탑벌 동네 증명이야 마득죠. 스탑벌 강아지 동이야 마득죠. 체계 남다. 근데 아 대화 쉽고 가네 같아요. 아주 좋네요. 이난 샘데라 면 체체 톰 송나노 근데 샘데 면 모인 발라 됐네. 안에서 강아지 때문에 Then it's simply give Nyencha then. Manage the young Nyencha Dandaji Chakopio. The Yendu Shanshi Sengi Najo Nyamlin Dena Sim Jungbo Chakpo Kova Gambora. I'm young when I send the Shin Gambora. Then Nyencha Dandona Yunchik Majik Shanshi.
So Rinpoche was commenting, this is, I think, commenting more on our discussion this morning about what it's like when we practice bodhicitta. And Rinpoche said, think about the quality of our ordinary mind. We're not talking about the mind's ultimate nature, but just the nature that we're experiencing all the time. Rinpoche said he would characterize it as being rigid and inflexible. And what causes it to be rigid and inflexible? Well, our mind is full of conceptual thoughts, and especially our strong affective emotions, desire, anger, jealousy, arrogance, all of these make the mind rigid and hard. And then on top of that, we have all of these ideas of I and ego grasping and identity, and these make us rigid and hard. So really, when we think about what bodhicitta is, then bodhicitta is the superior method to make the mind flexible. And last night, Rinpoche was talking about how there are outer, inner, and secret forms of yoga. No. Sorry, that was wrong. But there are yogas of body, speech, and mind. And a bodhicitta is a form of mental yoga or mind yoga. And then let's talk about what yoga itself is. So in the Tibetan language, yoga is a compound word, najo, or two syllables. So the first syllable of the word yoga means relaxed. And then the second syllable of the word yoga means a master. So master of relaxation. So when we think about physical yoga, we're achieving relaxation of the body, which is enabling us to continually maintain our flexibility. So we can apply this to the mind then. If the mind is continually training in the bodhicitta, the mind is achieving relaxation and then continually maintaining its flexibility. And so that's what we would describe as the yoga of bodhicitta, continually achieving and maintaining flexibility. And if we're constantly bringing bodhicitta to mind, this is actually an effortless process, just in the same way warmth comes from fire. Again, our ordinary state of mind is devoid of flexibility. Because we're set in our ways and we're rigid and we feel that our way is the right way. But Rinpoche said, what happens when we come from a place that lacks flexibility? Well, when the mind is inflexible, then when we look at the outside world, we also see problems and we see suffering and we feel that things are inflexible. We feel that nothing's workable, and this is a very painful way to relate to the world. But on the other hand, when that flexibility is coming from inside the mind, when we look outside, we see that our situations are flexible. The mind is flexible, which makes everything flexible. So we can think of the yoga of bodhicitta or bodhisattva conduct as being a method to create a flexible mind. And those of us who are maybe realizing that the kind of rigidity that generally we embody is very painful, then bodhicitta is also something absolutely necessary.
Tere, te yendo. Marang soki, tangko, tashet de.
So from a Buddhist point of view, we always examine first, is it logical? And maybe in Western culture we say, like, use your brain or use your intelligence, but from the Buddhist point of view, we always think, like, if you start out in this way, then what's the logical conclusion? And Rinpoche said he feels like if you do examine the way bodhicitta works and sort of our ordinary experience, that you will find that this is logical. When we think about the way that we perceive the world, so we being the perceiving subject and then sort of individuals and the world around us, we do see complications when we feel rigid and inflexible. And Rinpoche was describing how this happens using a metaphor. So this rigidity causes complications because the mind is narrow or inclined. So if you were in a valley or a canyon and there was a river flowing, because you're in a really small space, the sound of the water rushing over the rocks is very loud. And this is similar to an inflexible and rigid mind. That sound is filling the whole environment around you. But then say that you went to a totally different kind of environment, like where the Mississippi River is flowing through a vast plain, and you were in that plain. And the river there is actually so much bigger. But because you're in an expansive place, you don't hear the echo of the water. And so Rinpoche said this is similar to a mind that is flexible and relaxed and unconfined. So the vastness, the spaciousness of that place allows those complications or that loud sound to dissolve. If you take that and you apply it to a bodhisattva, someone who's tamed their mind, who's cut through at least a good part of their identity and has become flexible, when they're out there in the ordinary world, it's not that they're interacting with a different world or any different kind of place than you would ordinarily go, but because their mind is flexible, those ordinary problems aren't painful for them. They don't see complications in the way we do. They don't grasp on to complications in the way that we do. And we could liken the ordinary mind to something like a bed of thorns. So if you're laying on a bed of thorns, the minute you move just a little bit, you get poked, and it's very painful. And our ordinary mind is full of thorns. Because we're rigid and we're inflexible, when we try to move around even a little bit, it hurts. And Rinpoche said the way that we dull the thorns or we pull the thorns out of the ordinary mind is by meditating on bodhicitta and restoring that flexibility to the mind. And this this is a quote by Shantideva, not in this part of the text. But he said, there is no other discipline than subduing the mind. So the very best activity that we could engage in is subduing our own minds, is cutting through our own ego, because when we do that, we're able to benefit ourselves and others. Sometimes people come to Rinpoche and they say, you know, I want a protector practice or a protector prayer. And Rinpoche said, sometimes we think about ourselves and we think, well, if I put myself right in the middle, I'm protecting myself. But Rinpoche said, bodhicitta is the best protector. And he tells us that in Denver. People ask, why is bodhicitta the best protector? And Rinpoche said, because if the mind is flexible, then things lose their ability to bother you. And you're protected from the inside. You're just becoming a bigger-minded person. So if this sounds logical to you, Rinpoche said, if you can understand the logic of how this path works and it makes sense, then you need to learn more and you need to train it. If this sounds illogical to you, of course, you shouldn't train at something that seems illogical. But Rinpoche said, from his own point of view, he sees nothing more powerful than transforming the essence of our experience than training in bodhicitta. And of course, this will eventually lead to liberation from
samsara. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the thing that I'm going to do.
Among all of those beings, It is only realized beings or very well spiritually trained beings who know how to take their suffering to the path. But in the West, we do have an ordinary good motivation to work from. For example, many of us, even if we don't have any spiritual training, we're worried about the environment. We're worried about helping others. We see others experiencing poverty or war or famine, and we want to do something to help them. And so this verse tells us that those of us who wish to dispel the suffering of both ourselves and others should never turn away from bodhicitta. Again, if we think of just what happens when suffering is dispelled, we attain happiness. So for example, if we're able to completely cure a sickness, we achieve some kind of happiness because that sickness is no longer present. And Rinpoche said now he wants to have a little bit of a discussion about this idea that the very basis or samsara's very nature is suffering, because he's not sure what people think about that idea. Mm.
Do you believe in that, or you disagree the nature of samsara and suffering? You disagree with me. It's good to discuss this topic because we might think samsara or the world, the nature of the world, is not suffering. And we might think nature of the world or nature of samsara is not suffering, therefore we can skip different pains, different problems. So North Americans do have that way of thinking. Well, maybe not Canadians, but people in the US, they do. Okay?
What is meant by the nature of? So you say the nature of samsara is suffering, but those words, the nature of, can you describe what that means?
Its very essence. The thing itself is suffering. So, like, expressing it in that way implies that no matter where you went, you couldn't find a place where it's not so, because that's its very nature. So I think that's why Rinpoche is asking you to think about it, because a lot of times we make exceptions. We're like, well, a lot of these things are suffering, but this part of my life, I like this part of samsara. So a lot of times our certainty that the nature of samsara is suffering is not that deep. Or we think, sometimes we think so, but when things are going well, we don't think so. So Rinpoche is kind of asking us to think
yeah.
about what that means.
It's really important to have certainty on nature of samsara. Other ways, it's really hard to accept suffering, accept problems or whatever. And some of my students say, Rinpoche, I like the happy part of suffering. Samsara. No, you're wrong. Because the nature of samsara itself is suffering. Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile the fact that sometimes we are happy? So we are happy sometimes. Right now I'm feeling pretty good about life. That's good. I know this will change.
Mm-hmm.
So I recognize that the nature of samsara is suffering from the point of view that there will be suffering. There has been suffering. Sometimes there's suffering, but sometimes we're feeling pretty good.
Right?
So we're not always suffering
good.
All the time.
Good. Right. Right now, maybe some of you who are enthusiastic about web bodhisattva teachings, you are happy. But some of you really not enthusiastic about the path and the teachings, you're unhappy. But the thing is, when you're happy, that's good samsara, kind of, right? and you're happy. Mm-hmm. You like it. The problem is we like it too much. And we forget. We forgot there's a change to that state of mind. But the thing last night I said is, when you're happy, enjoy it, but don't cling on. When you have a good relationship, for example, you're so happy when you just start dating or just got married. Honeymoon and everything seems perfect. And you should be happy. Samsara is going to come. Very soon. So then, problem is, we do not have a certainty about the nature of samsara, right? So therefore, when we had a good relationship, because it doesn't mean your relationship is bad, but you were too attached to that period of time in your life. Then if there's a change, right, you say, oh my God, this relationship is just the hell. If I knew, I should not get married. This marriage was so good. And what happened? Because you are not aware of the nature of samsara. It's changing. But the thing is, when you were having that perfect moment, you should enjoy it. You're not attached to it. And then it will change. Then when change happens, again, you're aware of, oh yeah, I am in samsara. Well, this thing changing happened, and healthy things are alright. Maybe, like, you are showing so many things that your partner or friends have never noticed, because you have been buried that for 3 years. Because you have to pretend you're good, otherwise who wanted to ask you marry? But you cannot pretend that forever. At one point you have to show it. But when you show it, if the other one is not really aware of the nature of samsara and things are changing, then they see you a terrible person. So, but the thing is, when we really see things always change, and things always up and down, as I said last night. But if we really practice bodhicitta and find the certainty of the nature of samsara, it really does not bother us. So make us say, oh, okay, yeah. Oh, I see it. Okay. So like, you can become a really good
surfer.
You just know, okay, yes. Your body becomes flexible, your mind becomes flexible. Because of the deep understanding of nature of samsara. And because of that practice of bodhicitta.
Well, you're not expecting it to be something else.
Right. So your expectation is not like that. If you have a, like an expectation, then that expectation is that goal. If things are not really what you expected, then it's really hard to accept. And then, this is so true, though. And North America, people have so many choices in your life, right? Maybe right now your relationship is not like friendship or whatever. This community is not so good. And it's fine. I have like it's so easy to travel to the other town. You can completely forget your old town and people you knew 5 years ago. But if you be here for another a year or two, then another problem is again rising here. Because it's the nature of samsara. Wherever we go, whatever we do, wherever we live, that thing about samsara is always there. But if we really do understand that, it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't bother you that much. But right now, we always have some difficulties with everything because our understanding of the nature of samsara is really shallow. Even though it's a rude word, I'm going to use it. It's really shallow. But if we really practice bodhicitta, tame the mind, tame the ego, then really samsara cannot bother us anymore. I tell this all the time. It's so important. There are a group of young people, young North Americans think, Canada is getting awful. It's not a nice country anymore. It's not like before. Maybe I should go to Asia. Somewhere Asia is perfect. People are always smiling. That doesn't mean they're not facing samsara. They have it there also. If you go there, be there for a while, you will see the nature of samsara. So, and this teaching says, if we really want to handle the nature of the samsara, so many sufferings we are dealing with, if we really want to benefit others, bodhicitta practice. Shantideva Baba said, only bodhicitta practice helps us to achieve the goal we have. John.
One of the things that's always attracted me to the Buddha Dharma is that the Buddha Dharma seems to be addressing the nature of reality. And one of the ways that the Buddha Dharma talks about addressing the nature of reality is the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth, as we know, is all life is suffering. So it's the truth of samsara. But the Buddha didn't stop there. There were three other noble truths. Mm-hmm. And my understanding has been that if we follow the path, and the path of bodhicitta, there is the complete elimination of samsara. That samsara is an illusion that we foist upon ourselves because of our ego, our grasping, our afflictive emotions. But in and of itself, there is no such thing as samsara. So it's not that... It's like, so there is samsara, there's no question about that, just the way we're talking about it. And that's nothing to be avoided, and the path is in the way of avoiding samsara, but the path is a way of gaining freedom from samsara. Is that a correct understanding, Rinpoche?
Okay. I think, yeah, I agree with you, but the way you explain as more ultimate point of view. From ultimate point of view, there's no samsara, and there's no me.
Right.
But we all agree, there's I. If you don't think there's no I will find you for you. I will find you. So that is the truth of suffering, it is there. Not that hard to find it, right? Conventional, it is always there. Of course, from ultimate point of view, if you know how to use the technique, the teachings. If you really analyze where the suffering is, where the samsara is, where I is, where ego is, where self-attachment is, we cannot pinpoint. Where I is, where samsara is. But we still experience I is always here. And the samsara is always there and bothering us. Of course, yes, you're saying it's more ultimate point of view. Mm. And this is maybe logical for some of you to hear John's explanation. But the thing is, sometimes if we really do not work on conventional level, it's really hard to go beyond conventional level. Ultimate level, yeah, oh yeah, okay. It's like a dream, it is. Life is a long, complicated dream. It is like a dream. You sit here and now think your past. It is just like a dream. You cannot touch anything of things you experienced, whether it's good or bad, happy or sad. But you can still remember that. It's just like a dream. But in present moment, you can really, it's almost
tangible.
But the thing is, Shantideva's teaching is, he's telling us bodhicitta can help us to really know how to work with this tangible samsara, suffering and problems, and make it easy to work with.
So, for those of us who are still in a bit of denial that the nature of samsara is
are
suffering,
you the person a little bit denial?
I think so. I think I see it intellectually when I read it and I examine it and I look for evidence. Yes, oh yes, the nature of samsara is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But then when something joyful happens,
mm-hmm.
that's very real and I forget that the nature of samsara is suffering. So I'm wondering how can I develop certainty that the nature of samsara is suffering?
Well, I think you need, that's true, when you have a like really joyful period of time, you really do forget. Everything seems fun. Everything seems good. But the thing is, we shouldn't always think about the nature of samsara. It's depressing. If you really always think about the samsara, nature of samsara, it is depressing. But if you really train on the nature of samsara and see whatever is happening like a dream, like an illusion, or like a movie, then you do not really attach to whether it's like happy states or sad states, because everything becomes almost like
I think it's more even,
right? So you do not have to completely forget the nature of samsara when you are having good times, right? The thing is, you should aware, oh, I'm having this perfect moment, and I should rejoice, and I should also dedicate this happiness, and wish other beings also can have this kind of happiness and this. this kind of a joyful experience, then you're not really going to be. And when it changes, then you are not going to be able to adapt. And it's going to change. And it's easy for you to accept. And life is going down? Okay. Yeah. And then it's going up? Oh, no. It's easy to accept things. And it's easy to accept changes. Other ways, it's going to be a little bit tricky.
She's
honest.
Should I come up? Too much of? Please, honest. Exactly. 99% of spiritual practitioners, really, intellectually, they do understand nature of samsara and suffering. But they really do not want to accept from their heart.
When I was younger, I always had a good nature, so I was a happy, happy type person.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when I analyze my happiness, or the moment where I'm happy, it is these moments where, if I think now, because I'm taking the teaching of Bodhisattva, and I'm reading here and there, and your teaching, so it is these moments, it's when I apply small doses of Bodhisattva, or Bodhicitta, like compassion, real compassion. So I discover now that when I was happy with my wife or with my parents, it wasn't the attachment to them that was made me happy. It is the pure compassion to my parents, to my mother, the pure loving kindness that I applied to them. Of course, not to the level of Bodhisattva, but to the small doses. That's the thing that made me feel happy. It is the moment when I see in the eyes of another person how great is he, even if he's poor on the street, when I connect, these moments made me always the happiest person. And so now I'm not astonished. So I make everything makes sense to me. Because I was happy only when I felt the real, these really strong Bodhisattva values, the six parameters. So it makes sense, everything. All my life I was happy, but these things made me happy. Not when I had a new, very nice car, not when I was attached to my wife, on the contrary. So what I want to say is, it makes sense. So what I want to say at the same time, we can feel happiness, but we can feel happiness when we apply the Bodhisattva, because that's the real happiness. But the other ones are not happiness.
Rishi, can I ask a question from the a little bit of the yogic discipline question of samsara and suffering, and then a bit of the path? And what I'm on is that, as I understand it, from the yogic perspective, 10,000 years of Vedas are the oldest written spiritual scriptures, 10,000 years. And the general description I heard was that most cultures and people go through a place where they move from a place of sacrifice, so back onto the topic, where they think there's something external to themselves, and in order to find happiness, they have to sacrifice something to those gods, and then the weather will be good, or the weather won't be good, and those sorts of things. And then the progression yogically moved to the point that there was then an idea, and this is, for those that study yoga in the room, that happiness in the yogic path meant that you joined your small s self, so you're attached to this self, to an Atman or super self, and that union was then the movement. And so there were various disciplines that the yogis put forward to do that. And then Buddha Shakyamuni studied some of those disciplines and then came up with the Four Noble Truths. But in the middle of all of that, there's this part that I'm confused about that connects back to samsara, which is what I want to come to, which is that somewhere in there they became aware of what's known as the tantric path. And in the tantric path, they seem to be saying that everything is sacred. And so that samsara, if it is part of everything, they landed and said, no, no, it's a mistake to see samsara as something bad or something negative. And yet really then they started to develop, you know, philosophies and things around that idea that all of this is sacred. And so I have a hard time thinking, well, if samsara is suffering, but it's sacred, then how do we move to that place?
Sure.
Of embracing
it's a really good, really good question, David. The thing is, also, it's pretty much related to John's.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
John is talking about ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tantra teachings are based on pure perception and ultimate point of view.
Uh-huh.
Immediate Tantra is like the qualities slowly manifest. It's like heart, right? Outward. And go from the essence of that reality and ultimate teaching and ultimate practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, a little bit sutra teachings and the tantra teachings, a little bit having like a little bit of like this,
mm-hmm.
little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really know tantra and the sutra teachings, there is no conflict between tantra and the sutra teaching. Sutra teaching is more beneficial, more suitable. For example, if there are 100 people are practicing Dharma, and it is easy for 99 people to agree, sutras, because it's more like direct. We can taste it. We can taste suffering. We can taste that tangible happiness and the tangible suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand and easy to introduce and easy to explain.
Mm-hmm.
But if we just jump into Tantra, say, oh, you don't have to practice. I am the Buddha. You don't see me as Buddha. Even if I say I am a Buddha, right? It doesn't make sense.
Right.
You have to develop that deep understanding and a pure perception and a connection and the Tantra tradition. You have to have that karma connection. Otherwise, you have no idea what the hell is going on here. Right? If I say, like, oh, yeah, everything, this cup is like, oh, yeah, pure thing. This yoga studio is like a palace.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimate point of view, yeah, sure. But conventional level.
Mm.
So therefore, sutra teachings and masters in sutra tradition, they're really trying to help every single spiritual beings try to connect the spiritual path and introduce conventionally and then work with master of a conventional level and use logics and educated people and use logic and they say, okay, yes, samsara and self, slow, and then they introduce, for example, conventional bodhicitta, which is most of where we go to stuff that have 10 chapters and 9 chapters about the conventional bodhicitta. Right? So they really try to develop conventional bodhicitta and help practitioners familiar with conventional bodhicitta and really mingle their mind with conventional bodhicitta. Then when they really understood a conventional bodhicitta and it used to conventional bodhicitta practice when they have chapter 9. Then they teach about wisdom and ultimate. Then when you were teaching ultimate, even like from this text, oh, okay, if you have a potential and a karma connection with the tantra teaching, oh, okay, it has to be everything is sacred, right? Yeah, so one is teaching from ultimate levels, but maybe 1 or 2% of practitioners really understand, really can connect. Otherwise, it's hard. So therefore, a lot of Western people, it seems, easy to connect with ultimate. But then a lot of Western Buddhists really put the conventional bodhicitta and these things aside. Then when we do that, that ultimate teaching becomes another identity, and makes Western Vajrayana Buddhists' head too big. It doesn't fit in North America. But bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, really helps us to make our head smaller and fit on our body. It's so important.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to hear you teach for a couple of years now, and what I've heard you say, and of course this could be all my imagination, but what I've heard you saying is that however we look at it, conventional bodhicitta is ultimate pure perspective, that they're actually one and the same. And so there's no point in going to the ultimate pure perspective and trying to leap there, because here we've got everything we need. We have you, we have Allison, we have Sangha, we have the teachings. So we have everything we need to actually completely experience bodhicitta now and with this life that we have. And if we really experience it now, here, then the ultimate point of view is just obvious. It's just there.
Okay. It's really good, John. You point out a really important subject. Right? Conventional bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta. At one point, it has to be inseparable. Conventional bodhicitta actually is the expression of ultimate bodhicitta. Without both of these, we cannot have that completed or holistic wisdom. If we really work with the conventional bodhicitta, I'm not encouraging you, saying, oh, ultimate bodhicitta is not a word. And the tantra teachings are so important. But until we really mature enough to understand and to digest those tantra teachings and ultimate teachings, then those teachings cause us more samsara, make our ego bigger. But when we really work with the conventional bodhicitta and work with the ego, then when we really receive those ultimate teachings, tantra teachings, we're ready. We're perfect beings. It's like, yeah, conventional bodhicitta cleans up our dishes, beautiful cup. And then when ultimate teachings pour into this pure, perfect vessel, everything is there. Until then, even though ultimate teachings we receive, that doesn't stay in this canteen. That is causing some teeny tiny.
share, we are talking about samsara, and traditionally there are three types of samsara, right? Three types of suffering. Suffering of suffering, which is very easy to understand, I can understand that. So suffering of suffering can be have physical pain, mental pain, so it's very easy to notice. I agree with that 100%. Suffering of change. When something good, they change for something bad, we suffer because we want good, we don't want to have bad. Easy to see, easy to understand, easy. I agree with that. Third part.
Well, the second one.
Suffering of change, when we have something good, and we like it, our mind goes well, and then something happened, and we don't like it very much. So we suffer because we want this good, what is going on in our life, we don't want anything bad happen, and we suffer because we don't like this good. And when we have an uncomfortable time, a pleasant time, which is again, we want to have a good, we don't want to let that to continue. So this is suffering of change, very easy to perceive it, very easy to understand it. Agree, 100%. But the third suffering, it's called pervasive condition. This is very hard, I still don't have a clear understanding. My understanding is that all things are impermanent and because they kind of don't have inherited nature. This is my understanding of this. Could you please say more about that and explain it? Because I understand this kind of called pervasive suffering. This is, I think, the hardest part of suffering to kind of see and understand.
Okay. I don't think it's that hard. That's the point I was talking about nature of samsara, which is suffering. No matter where you are, no matter who you are, we all have suffering. The matter is a little bit different. We all have that suffering. Because we're human beings, or we're sentient beings. So if you are a being, you have that pervasive suffering. So we cannot understand that. No matter what we do, since we were born, that is almost like shanti.
It's innate.
And we always have that. So, Tati goya se na korang ki korwa dukna ka rangjin yamba de la neshi za mo ji thop thop na khapan dushit ka dukna de hama pe yo khapan dushit ka dukna mesa ki nes na wa suno ki ji de na shuba ji ki sem je ni cha da pe ja yo na ngirwa ji ki tene de ma cha pa me ba cha ni cha de
So all pervasive suffering is actually based on our deep certainty in If we reflect on the other two kinds of certainty, and if we become completely certain that all of samsara, that our experience, either sooner or later, will result in suffering, then all pervasive suffering becomes easy to recognize. It's like the logical result of having deep certainty in suffering. So whether it be the outer world which appears around us, or beings that we interact with, no matter what it is that we encounter or where we are or who we connect with, sooner or later, it will result in suffering. And so that suffering is all the reason.
Yeah. 김상가를 했잖아. 묘모바 리니 충충 안 뇽뇽 마차가 바르도 리는 묘모바라 때문에 감성 걸어와라 끼고 감성 걸어와라 깨릴 상태 Kapan the shit got of my magazine.
And we may ask, like, why is it that we're born into this condition? Rinpoche said our suffering is almost innate. It's like a condition that we experience. And why is that? Well, because of our afflictive emotions, because of the strength of our afflictive emotions, and because we are still have accumulated a vast amount of negative karma. So until our afflictive emotions begin to decrease, and until we begin to purify our karma, until we reach a certain level of purification, we will take birth in samsara. And so when we're accompanied by these strong afflictive emotions and karma, suffering is all pervasive for us.
Okay. I think it's good that the shanti is same thing. Good that the big one is Tangi or a Damada, Chikone, Tangi, they got it, they say, Tayon Tangi. Tayon Tamba say at it, Maram for Chanchukisan, the Totpa kid, Chetu, Fungu. Totpa, then Chanchukisan, Yamnim Chena, Tayon Hatam Chungo Chigan Sare, Sam, Tila, Yamnim Chia, some of them, Gongong Yak Chetu. I think I was going to say that. Shan's kissing the eight and my tongue of the gun said, I'm going to go. Shan's kissing you, my buddy. Kima, get a sketchy Daniel. Comes from Korwala, Chung Shaki, Tapanda, but then Dochak and Jerry of the Mook. Dochak and Jerry of the Mook. Dam yung kan ke kansa konsepsi ni kita nyam tapa, nyam tapa sih nak tuhkan ni kepa. Tetapi sama de nyam tapa de le draw. Dewa siapa jop sange ke tuk sete de shanti sempat sih kau. Shanti sempat de sange ke sete dah baca kau ni sungguh. Tetapi masa shanti ke sen cuma main bay yung kan ke kansa sih kita mana. Jisting ke kandalaya, kuba. Sunjuk tu aja, cakap kuba siapa. Jisting thamar juga, siapa siapa yang jalan sini, tapi siapa siapa sini, siang sah sah, siang sah tu yang orang baca balik, sungguh. Tapi kahwin ni sini, siang cik kesem cuma mampu jadi lah, kena segera. Siang cik kesem cuma mampu jadi lah, kita bingkang sate na, tera boh mixer. They are chopped together in that song. They yen yak against the carriages and a marrow of Tumu Semchenki come down. A wombo, the samba, the sola samotic down yonga. Marrow of Karamjin next chap. Yen naya, Shanchip Kassem de Xenger Kustur. The name Xenger Kustur take a chap song, stonch of mongo. Сер гэрияк нүвад ёо эсэ сэмдэр кэстэ. Хчяк сэм стончок мон бо сэмдэр кэстэ ла пар гэрная татун сэмдэр кэстэ дэ маня. Тэнэ маа уз тумун да бо янас тэнэ сэмдэр кэстэ дэ гэ жамба ж сэмдэр кэстэ зона сэн да бо зона тэнэ тэнэ сэмдэр кэстэ дэ мэ ба чуро гэ тэ да бо маа бо шанч кэ сэм тэнэ. Хчяк стун стон तो जुगल कभी आतू सेल के कुछ दे ज़बान में बता न्यान में बता नांजन नांजन तो काम से खोरवा की सेंचन की सेल का गिट्टे ला शंचिप के सेल की सेल के कुछ दे सेल के तो ये नांजन छोटा वो मकसद नहीं तो नांजन गैर भी करें जो नांजन में पर गैर चेप आप शंचिप सेल भी शहर आते हैं तो तुम भी वाले तो ये तो दे मकसद वाके लिए से ना न्योमो बा तू ना तो तू सुन के मकसद वाके लिए ना ये सुन थाम चेते शंचित किस्से सेल्ज किस्से ना बोले कि रुंबोचा रंथंग तंचारा ना बोले गेट भी और ऐसे हो ते यंतु ते ये भी चाहने जाम शंचित किस्से दे ना न्याने भी आता आह शंचित किस्से दे ये ला दिन याने हाथ
So, Pumshek didn't mention, but this first introductory chapter is called The Excellence of Bodhicitta. And the point of this chapter, or the goal of this chapter, is to help us understand why bodhicitta is actually something that we would want to make effort at and practice. So, until now, we've sort of been introducing that idea. But in the verses that are following, the ones Rinpoche just taught on, are giving metaphors to explain the good qualities of bodhicitta. So in the way of using metaphor, it's either praising bodhicitta or explaining how bodhicitta helps us. So first of all, Rinpoche said, when we give rise to an uncontrived bodhicitta, and uncontrived means like not forced, but like real and genuine bodhicitta from the heart, even for an instant, it loosens us from the rope or the shackles of our afflictive emotions. So in that moment that bodhicitta is really in the heart, we're actually liberated from all of those rigid feelings and that constriction of our identity and all of the things that we act out because of it. And it is said that in the instant that we give rise to true bodhicitta in the heart, we also become an heir of the bodhisattvas. We become connected to the bodhisattvas. And then there's a line in one of the verses that said, when we give rise to bodhicitta, we're revered by all of the world gods and humankind. And Rinpoche said what that's referring to is that when you meet someone with bodhicitta, then you can see it in them. And that person is different than other people. You can just see that feel that there's something different about that person. And bodhicitta really has that expression of being something special and distinct in a person. And when you meet a person like that, they really can bring out the best in you. It's really special. And then the next verse is talking about alchemy and how bodhicitta is like the process of alchemy, and it has the ability to transform everything that it comes into contact with. But bodhicitta is not just like an ordinary alchemy substance, because it never gets used up and it never degrades. It's like this wish-fulfilling quality where there's no scarcity. It has the ability to transform anything, and so this idea of being very vast-minded. It says in that verse that our impure body will be transformed into a precious jewel.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to stop there. We did not finish a lot, but I'm not going to teach verse by verse this time in Canada. I'm doing that in Denver because these people have been with me for at least 6 or 7 years. I'm not saying you guys are not ready, but it's good to give teachings that maybe fit for you. I'm sure there are a group of people have been practicing Dharma and have been studying, and the thing is, I'm teaching the way of Bodhisattva for Western people is we should try to our Dharma practice.
Try to what?
Make our Dharma practice authentic. Really. That's the goal I have. You do not have any problem to understand the teachings intellectually. You can. And you can read it. And you can just close the book and go in a coffee shop or someplace. There's a Dharma meeting and you can go there and you can be the center of that group and you can drag in there. And you can say, oh, I learned this, and I read this, and this is bodhicitta, that is bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta is like this. You can drag a lot. That's not the point I'm teaching whoever bodhicitta here. What's that? Use the teachings and train your mind. I like to say, carve the teaching on your heart and in your mind. That's the goal I have. If you are really new to this kind of a topic, I think there are some people who are doing yoga. Right? You're really new. But try to be open-minded. And when you do yoga, and when you come to this yoga studio, say you're coming to train that yoga teacher, become a yoga teacher. If you want to be a yoga teacher, you have to learn every part of your physical body, and you need to know what really helps your physical yoga. And not just to learn, and you need to maintain that yoga practice. Otherwise, how can you teach the yoga, physical yoga, skillfully, for others. You can't. So Bodhicitta teachings and the Dharma teachings are also the same thing. When you learn, listening to the teachings, and a discussion, contemplating on the teaching, and use the teaching, not just at the program. We need to bring this teaching into our world. Bring them. That's the goal I have. It's simple, it's easy. Easy topic. But it's a really hard practice to be a master, because we have to give a lot of our ego and identity. We have to be really flexible. We have to be really open. So some of you have been practicing and studying with me for a number of years. And we have a small sangha here, and in Ottawa. In Ottawa and Montreal. So the thing is, if we really use this teaching in our sangha and apply this teaching in our sangha, sangha will become an authentic group. There won't have any this ego thing. So important. Just remember this, please. We all are so different. Therefore, our ego is so different. And some of us are so good for some things. And some of us are not good for some things. But we should always remember, not just always focusing on the weakness part of other people. Judge the weakness part, always. That's what we human beings do. So therefore, when we have the Bodhisattva teachings and trying to develop our Bodhicitta, why can't we search that and try to what good qualities others have, other Sangha members have, and other people have. And think about that part. It's easier. As a Western Buddhist Lama, I'm not Western, but I pretend to be a Buddhist Lama in the West, so it's easy for me to teach when I use this technique. Really, really difficult, neurotic Western Dharma students come to me and make me exhausted. But I do not always focus on the weakness part of that person. Really annoying, though, but I do think positive part of that person. Huh. Okay, this is a Dharma student. It's really annoying, really demanding, really needy, but what quality this person has. And think about that. And every single person has a good quality, not just one, couple of good qualities. Then when I see that, okay, yes, I can let go of that. I can really try to help and develop that connection. And I can really help those Dharma students. And it really makes me happy, because I'm not breaking Bodhisattva vows. I have a Bodhisattva vows. I really always think my Bodhisattva vows, no matter what I do. Before I say something, I think about Bodhisattva vows. Before I do something, I think about Bodhisattva vows. Before I think something, I think about Bodhisattva vows. So when I think, like, oh, this is good, okay, this person has this, even though this person is difficult, then that helps me to maintain my bodhicitta. So that happens in the sanghas a lot. Right? Some sangha members are so annoying. Some sangha members are so also nice, but also they have their own thing going on. So we all are not perfect. Therefore, we need this kind of teachings and this practice. And it really help us, not just helping our own spiritual practice, and we can really lead others, and we can really help others. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's it. And then if you have a question, we do. I will answer the question. If you don't, we will do practice, because there are some people who want to do some sitting meditation.